Okay, everybody, welcome back to The Takedown. I'm your host, Dr. Nick Reiner, and today with me, I have Dr. Michael Meehan, MD. He's a musculoskeletal expert and health optimization specialist. His treatment plans focus on conservative, non-operative measures to help the individual improve function, pain control, mobility, and longevity. He uses evidence-based interventions to restore, regenerate, and rejuvenate the client to allow them a limitless life. He employs proactive approaches, including fitness and strength training, mind-body techniques, hormone optimization, regenerative interventional orthopedic medicine, peptides, epigenetic testing, sexual health interventions, and aesthetic procedures to maximize health span and vitality. He's also the author of the best-selling book on Amazon called A New You, Using the Body's Regenerative, Restorative, Healing Powers to Optimize Orthopedic, Hormonal, and Sexual Health Function. Dr. Mike, how are you, sir?
I'm great. How about you, Dr. Nick?
I'm well, man. It's good to have you here. I got to say, you know, a couple of the things that we chatted about before bringing you on here today, we share a lot of the same interests, and I'm very excited to have you on. And one thing I was telling the guy that we had on last week, that the most exciting thing for me to have you guys on here is I get to learn something new every single time I do this. And for somebody like you with your knowledge base, I'm excited to chat with you. So I appreciate you being here, sir.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to it. It's been a long time coming, and looking forward to learning from you as well as I have already. So,
well, for those of you that don't know, Dr. Mike and I are we have chatted behind the scenes. You know, we follow each other on Twitter, and I one of the things for me is that, you know, having somebody like Dr. Mike on with his experience and being an author and all the things he does, we share common interests, and we kind of do a lot of the same things. So we'll cover all those things. But the first thing I think I'd like to start off with, Doc, is getting into the topics for discussion, but first and foremost, what I like to do is talk about essentials and foundations for health. And for me, when I hear the word essential, these are things that are absolutely must to be well. And there's a couple of things here that I want to go through with you, so we can talk about them one each individually. So let's go first. Well, I'll tell you what, before we do that, because I have in the notes here, I have, essentials for health and cost and things like that. One of the things that I run into myself clinically is, you know, because we have direct primary care and some of the things that we do in our clinic, you know, a lot of this stuff is out of pocket. And although some of the service is out of pocket, there's a lot of things that people can do on their own that don't really cost anything. But we'll get to that. So let's first talk about effort and accountability. So in my opinion, I think you would agree with this. The biggest thing missing in healthcare is accountability. So would you mind, I guess, touching on that?
I agree. And I think, when we get going with patients, depending on, how you come at them or what their, complaints are, unfortunately, I think that we just focus on one specific issue and we really don't look at the client or the patient as a whole. Right. And, I think it's also incumbent upon a good relationship between yourself and, the client or patient that they're going to understand and be in it with both feet. Otherwise, you're just setting yourself up for failure both ways. And, the clinician, unfortunately, will then become a bit frustrated with the fact that you're coming forward with, seemingly good information, good treatment plans, and good options for the client to improve. And if they're not implementing, then you're really not, making a significant impact into, their goals as far as improving their overall health, overall function, overall performance, whatever their needs and desires are. So I think that's got to be a big piece. And unfortunately, sometimes that makes it a little bit, I don't want to say adversarial, but sometimes you have to challenge a client a little bit. And, everybody wants healthcare to be nice and clean and easy, and we come up with plans and everything goes perfectly. I don't think that's how things work, unfortunately. I think, and I'm a big fan of Tony Robbins, and I'm going to somewhat quote him here, but, he basically says big changes require big transformations. And, we don't get a lot of big transformations with just, niceties and not reinforcing the things that are necessary to move forward. And I think, like, if you think of any of the great coaches that you've had in the past, they treated you differently depending upon, you know, where you were and what you were understanding and that sort of thing. And, you know, kind of the same way with clients or patients. Some days necessary for them to have a hug and, you know, put your arm around them, obviously not in the COVID time, but before that, hopefully. Right, right. But, you know, sometimes they need that to get a little bit of feel and love and that sort of thing. Sometimes you have a great conversation and they get what you're describing and you get what their goals are and the conversation goes great. There's other times, unfortunately, that they're, you know, going into victim mode or really not taking ownership of some of their issues or problems. And sometimes, you know, proverbially, not physically, you have to kick them in the butt and
right,
kind of get them back on track and really get them focused again. And again, I'm going back to any of the coaches I've had, there are certain times where I needed chewed out and kicked in the butt to get my focus back and get where I needed to be. Or there were other times where, you know, I was not where I wanted to be, not necessarily because I wasn't listening, but maybe I had a bad day or something was going on at home. And I think they understood that as well. So it's a culmination of all activities. And, you know, the other piece, I think that with, you know, kind of the sick care model we have is everybody wants something fixed yesterday. You know, it's one or two or three visits. And then if it's not better, they're moving on to somebody else. I think you also have to instill the fact that these things are going to take months to even years to see some changes. Now, short term, you're going to start seeing some improvements quickly. I mean, that's very true. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, it's going to take you 12 to 18 months to see any improvement. But I think to totally get somebody optimized, to kind of get them transformed, to really get them where you want them to be and where they want to be, it's going to take, you know, I would usually tell folks at least 12 months, sometimes 18. So right, I think that's where these longer term relationships come up, and that's where you learn each other, and that's where you become a very good kind of symbiotic relationship and really get people moving forward. So, you know, it's like anything else. If you're trying to quit alcohol or stop smoking or you want to lose weight, or it doesn't matter what, if you want to bench press, you know, 315 pounds from 225, all of those are great goals. But if you're not in it with both feet and both hands, unfortunately, you're just not going to meet the requirements to get there.
I think that's, you made a ton of great points there. And I think a couple of comments that I have kind of to piggyback off of what you said is, you know, I feel personally at the very foundation of healthcare, one of the biggest things that's missing is the accountability, like you said, you know. And I tell my patients that I'm more or less kind of a glorified coach. You know, if you think of the typical healthcare model that, you know, maybe if you're seeing your doc annually, you know, you're going there, they're doing vitals, they do some labs, and if something comes back, if some blip comes back, they, you know, here's Synthroid, here's something else, and then, you know, come back and see me another year. There's no real connection or you know, accountability in that time. And the way that we have things set up, you know, I have several providers in my clinic and I have a certain patient base and everybody has their patient bases. But for me, you know, there has to be some sort of communication and accountability, whether it's, you know, what we typically do is we do emails and, you know, some like text message and stuff like that. But coaching, like you said, I mean, there has to be some sort of that accountability there. Otherwise, you know, if patients don't have that connection, then it's easier for them to fall off. Even if they're seeing somebody rarely who knows their stuff that can help them. If there's no connection, I guess that, you know, there's not a great of a chance of them being successful at that. And the time frame, like you mentioned too, man, I mean, if it takes decades to get well or to get sick, it might take a little bit of time to get well. So I think that's important as well to set those expectations. But so with health, healthcare, I had tweeted earlier about I made a comment about homeostasis. I said what some people call a miracle, I like to call homeostasis. And like you, I agree that there are certain things that we just need in general. You know, we need air to breathe, we need food to eat, just that are essential. So let's cover some of these things. I tell you what, Doc, let's start with sleep and then we'll kind of go from there. So start with sleep for us, please.
And I think, you know, if you're looking at the lower hanging fruit, and, you know, everybody, I don't say everybody, but a good majority of people will look at health optimization or enhancement or really trying to live a limitless life and say, well, that's not for me. It's way too expensive. I can't afford all the pieces associated with that. And to some degree, some of the more expensive technologies or drugs or toys, maybe not. But I mean, there are so many things that we can do that are kind of low hanging fruit that you're right, really don't cost a lot. It's just a matter of making them more routine. They're not fun per se. They're not glamorous per se. They're not at times very exciting, but similar to anything else, when you're building a foundation, like you're building a foundation on a house or any other skill, you've got to get those routine things under control and or set down, not perfectly, but well, to really start seeing some change. So in my opinion, if you're not sleeping well, I think that is very challenging to get any other parts or pieces of health optimized. So, you know, I think one of the bigger things with sleep for me is I think people need to stick to a routine and get on a schedule. And, you know, that means going to bed at a certain time each night and trying to get up at the same time each day, whether that's Friday, whether that's Sunday, whether that's Wednesday. I think it's important to really get focused on that. And for certain people have a little bit of a different circadian rhythm, meaning that some people will get tired at 8 or 9 in the evening. Some may push that to 11 or 12.
Right.
And then that kind of adjusts when you get up and do some of the other pieces there. But I think one of the first things that I use in working with my clients on sleep is to really get focused on a routine and a schedule. Second one is to kind of turn off all your electronics, be it your cell phone, be it your TV, be it your computer, anything that's got light to it. Turn those off at least 90 minutes. And if you can do it 2 hours, that's the more ideal thing.
Yes.
Because again, it's the light and the blue light's one of the bigger things. And, you know, all of those technologies do have some blue blocking ways, and you can download those both on your cell phone and on your computer. And there are certain TVs that will actually do that as well. But I think that's incredibly important. Even limit the amount of artificial light that you're getting at night, because that's going to mess up and disrupt the release of your own melatonin from the pineal gland, which is going to affect your sleep pretty significantly. And then usually I'll have folks try to invest for those reasons, or if they say, look, these are the times the kids are in bed, I've got to get this work done, and I can turn it off 60 minutes. Okay, I can live with that. So getting some blue blocking glasses, I think, is very important. And you know, it's kind of a seasonal thing. I like to have people as much normal light. So in the summers, maybe not putting those on until 8 or 9 at night.
Yes.
In the winter, then yeah, you probably want to go to put those on at 6 or 7 p.m. because it's getting dark at 5 o'clock or so. So I think it's important to kind of limit that artificial or abnormal light going there. Then the other thing is not really to do any high stress or significant physical activity about 2 to 3 hours before bedtime. Again, I mean, I understand there are certain people who look, this is the only time I get to work out is, you know, an hour or two before bedtime. You know, there's give and take. Sure. Would I rather have them exercising as opposed to not? Absolutely, positively, yes. So again, you got to kind of tailor it to the client and the patient, depending on what they have available, what they can do. But if possible, try to adjust that as well. And then having them do some type of wind down activity before they go to bed, whether they like to read, whether they like to journal, if they're into prayer, any of those sort of things are wonderful. Meditation at that time is perfect and a great way to really kind of calm and get in touch with more of your parasympathetic nervous system, which is more of your calming nervous system. Mm-hmm. Really kind of get yourself prepared for sleep and some of the other pieces from that standpoint. And then, you know, I'm a fan of using some medications, not necessarily the ones that you think of that will make you go to sleep, like the Ambiens and some of the other things from that standpoint, which really tend to disrupt sleep long term. But I think a low-dose melatonin or a low-dose GABA or glycine can be very helpful and very reasonable. There are certain teas that can also be of benefit in trying to help, you know, get you in the mood for sleep. And, you know, trying to reiterate the fact that sleep's one of the main times that you're going to repair and recover.
Right.
Helps to, you know, reduce your inflammation. That's the time that you typically tend to release your testosterone and growth hormones, really kind of quell your cortisol levels and some of the other pieces from that standpoint. And overall just kind of rehabilitate and or restore yourself. And if your sleep's impaired, all of those things are going to go haywire. And unfortunately, you're going to be kind of chasing your tail if you're not able to get all, you know, quality and adequate sleep. You know, numbers, it kind of depends on the person, but I would say most of the data suggests about 7 to 9 hours.
Yeah.
There are a very small subset of the population. I'm talking probably less than 0.5% that can get away with less sleep. There are some people that think they can, and they really aren't involved in that. And there are ways to check that either via genetic or epigenetic testing. But the other thing that I think is important, if they have the capability, the opportunity, is to get some type of wearable technology, whether it be something like an Oura Ring or a Garmin Fenix watch or any of the things that can kind of track your sleep, I think is incredibly important, because there's some people who say, oh, I sleep great. And then you look at their numbers and they're sleeping poorly.
Right.
Or, you know, there's some people that go the other way and say, oh, man, I don't fall asleep, I don't sleep well. And you look at their numbers, you're like, well, overall, this looks pretty good. Must be some other piece of the strategy that seems to be off for you. And that's the part you need to figure out. So, I think getting sleep dialed in is probably the big piece right in the beginning that I think you really need to focus on. And, you know, I think an important part of getting people on a routine. And I think the biggest take home message I try to give to people is, you know, try to make it the same time each night and you get up the same time each day, and your body will kind of coordinate to that. And, you know, that's when things will kind of wind down at night. You release your good hormones. And then, you know, you do need cortisol. Everybody wants to vilify cortisol.
Right.
if we didn't have cortisol, we'd die. I mean, it's, you know, if you've got a significant lack of that, I mean, you've got Addison's disease, and then you've got to take prednisone for the rest of your life to fix it. What President Kennedy had.
Right.
So, you know, cortisol is an important hormone because that helps to wake you up, kind of get you going, you know, get you out of harmful situations, or you know, you've got to dodge a car coming at you, or, you know, God forbid you have to defend yourself. But if you need to do that type of things, you have to do it. So cortisol will allow you to do that. The problem comes is when, you know, the cortisol or that sympathetic tone is on all the time.
Yes.
And that's the piece that we've really got to focus on in trying to quell. And unfortunately, the way our environments are, the way our jobs are, the fact that we got light that we can have 24/7, some of the pieces from that standpoint kind of keeps that on. And that's where cortisol gets its bad name. But, you know, cortisol is absolutely a necessary piece of life. And again, if you don't have that, you're going to have some challenges and issues. So,
you know, I agree 100%. And the thing for me, as you're talking, this is all fantastic stuff, and I'm so into it. I would say that the thing that I am most interested these days is the whole, you know, the light and the, you know, the sleep and circadian rhythm. And there's a lot of people like yourself and others that, you know, I follow on social media that know a lot more about this than I do. And I think that, honestly, I would say maybe 75% of the people that come in, and here's the thing, I have people that'll come in that may have some of these other lifestyle things dialed in, doc. You know, nutrition is good, exercise is good, maybe stress management, they're doing a great job of increasing peace, but their sleep is lousy and they still have some of these lingering things going on. And when they get that kind of set, then you see all these things improve. But one of the things, you know, I wanted to chat with you about too, regarding, I guess, sleep, was what your thoughts and opinions were about food. I guess nutrition in general, obviously, but then food in relationship to circadian rhythm.
Sure. So, I mean, you and I are on the same page as far as, you know, our thoughts on fasting and intermittent fasting and some of the other intake pieces. And again, I mean, I think it gets a little bit too aggressive on Twitter and some of the other social medias, because there isn't one way to eat.
Right.
And I think, again, that's where epigenetic evaluation and kind of listening and talking to patients, you get a reasonable handle on what they are able to do. Am I a big fan of vegan or vegetarian? I am not. But if somebody wants to go that direction, then I can work with them in trying to do some alternative things to get them enough protein.
Right.
Look at supplementation to get them enough things like B vitamins, choline, some other things that are going to be lacking in that. But that being said, you know, biggest, easiest thing. I don't care what you want to follow, whether it's vegan, whether you want to follow carnivore, if you want to do paleo. We all can agree that if it comes in a bag, if it comes in a wrapper, if it comes in a can, probably not a great thing to
eat. Exactly.
A few exceptions to that. But for the most part, you know, the process crap, there's nobody that's going to agree with or disagree with that, in my opinion. If they do, then I can't help you.
Right.
But, you know, I think one of the biggest pieces, and we've seen with, you know, this virus, and even before that point, looking at people's health and all that, and the thing I try to pound home with most people is the fact that we've got to control blood sugar, we've got to control insulin release, which controls chronic inflammation. If we can control chronic inflammation, I can help you with pretty much every disease process you have, be it dementia, Alzheimer's, be it cardiovascular disease, be it gut-related issues, be it musculoskeletal problems,
right,
pain.
Right.
You know, it used to be, again, I mean, I've been in the musculoskeletal pain field for 20 plus years, and I was as guilty as anybody as far as somebody come in with one thing, you know, you focus on the shoulder, okay? Maybe I definitely did look, you know, up above at the neck and down the arm and some of the other pieces, but I didn't really focus on some of the other opportunities I had to really impact people's health. And it's really totally changed the way I've treated people from a pain standpoint, kind of looking at these pieces, whether it be sleep, stress, nutrition, you know, hormone status, and supplementation, where they are all the way around from that standpoint.
Yeah.
And to get people to understand that it all matters. It's not just one thing. It's not just, I'm going to stick, you know, stem cells in your knee and everything's going to be peachy keen and rosy.
Right.
If you're 50 to 80 pounds overweight, and
exactly,
eating poorly, and you're sleeping terrible, and you're drinking a six pack, and some of the other things associated with it.
Right.
And, you know, again, I mean, I think, and I'll tell myself too, I mean, I was as bad as anybody else for a while as far as what I was putting into my body. And I started having symptoms that were consistent with probably pre-diabetes or even type 2 diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started, you know, jumping on some of these things and really got into the fasting, intermittent fasting. And I'll tell you, that probably has been the thing out of anything else I've done. I've done a lot. That changed my feeling, changed my body composition, changed my brain health, changed recovery from exercise and the other pieces from that standpoint.
Right.
And really, you know, first time I won't say the first time, but really what kind of got me is when I was reading, I don't know where it was, might have been Men's Health, article on Wolverine.
Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, he was... he was doing intermittent fasting during the time he was exercising and doing the role, because it really helped him to cut weight, but also it was able to maintain his strength, and you know, he could exercise even a little bit. And I was like, you gotta be kidding me. that doesn't make any sense to me. But as I looked at it a little bit more and started diving into the literature a lot more and started doing it, it was like, wow, I get what he was saying now at this stage. So
yeah,
that's another piece that I really try to impart on people. And I think it's something that can be done by everybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a type 1 diabetic, yeah, you got to be a little bit careful.
Right.
And it's still doable, but, you know, those are the folks, unfortunately, can become a little hypoglycemic, or if they're type 2 and they're on insulin, you got to be a little bit careful with those folks as far as doing it too quickly and that sort. But, you know, otherwise, I mean, you can do this very, very quickly. You can see significant changes very quickly. This is one of the things that you can start seeing benefits within the first week or two.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I'm sure you've read all of Dr. Fung, Jason Fung's books, but if anybody wants a great resource for any of this and wants to get in the weeds a little bit, all of his books on intermittent fasting, he's got the obesity code and he's got the diabetes code. They're all great resources. Well written, they're funny, they're entertaining, they're not dry.
Right.
And he goes into very good detail as to why, you know, calories in and calories out has failed, why we've got the obesity epidemic, why diabetes management has failed. The nice part with him is he's still in the weeds. He's not one of these guys that's in some ivory tower and
right,
has a patient in years. I mean, he's still working as a nephrologist in Canada.
Right.
And, you know, still working with folks and has seen significant improvements. And he sometimes gets people that are, you know, down low, getting ready to lose limbs and lose kidneys and other things, and has really shown that nutrition and diet can make a significant impact. And then, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to just add, you know, you had mentioned how you found, or you read the article with Hugh Jackman. And what's interesting to me is whenever I talk to somebody about intermittent fasting that has heard of it before, they always have kind of like a similar story, like yours. And they said, oh yeah, you know, I heard a coworker talking about it. For me, I'll never forget this. It was about 13 years ago, on a Sunday afternoon, my mother was having dinner at her place, and one of my cousins was there. And he said, hey, Nick, did you ever hear of this thing called intermittent fasting? And he explained it to me. And I'm like you, I said, well, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, the more you you have to eat 7 meals a day, you know, to ramp up your, you know, in air quotes, metabolism. But I went home that night, that Sunday night, and I read for about 4 hours on it. And like you, I'm like, okay, well, this does make sense to me. And then that very next day, I started doing the 16-8, and I haven't looked back. So I just thought that was kind of funny, because everybody that I talked to about intermittent fasting kind of has a similar story with that.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, it's powerful, and it sounds daunting. It sounds difficult. It sounds hard. And in the beginning, I'm not going to say it's not challenging, but not long. I mean, for the first 7 to 14 days, it's an adjustment. It's a little different. And you get hungry, I'm not going to lie. And I still do, even though I fast, you know, I do, like you, I do 16-8, and then I'll do typically a 24-hour fast weekly or every other week. And then I'll usually do a 3 or 5 day fast quarterly.
Awesome.
And it's got significant benefits, both in relation to reducing chronic inflammation. But another area that we try to focus on with our folks that are looking at doing regenerative medicine, either PRP or stem cells, or even, you know, prolotherapy, where we're just primarily using dextrose, is fasting has been shown to stimulate your own stem cells, and actually has been shown to help you heal faster.
I'm a huge fan.
It's another endogenous way that you can kind of help to, you know, stimulate your own recovery and your own health and own growth. Yes. You've got stem cells in basically every part of your body except for your heart. And there are reasons for that we don't necessarily need to go into. But incredibly important to kind of do that. And then the other thing it's wonderful for is kind of doing your body's own spring cleaning.
Yes.
It does a process called autophagy, where you kind of chew up your dead, old, crummy cells and kind of get rid of them. And then there are a few cells, unfortunately, still around called senescent cells that sometimes can be problematic moving forward. And, you know, some of those can be treated. Unfortunately, most of those need to be treated with a more expensive type treatment regimen, which we also need to get into. But vast majority of those type of things that you can control, both with when you eat, how much you eat, and what type of food you eat. And again, the nice part, and usually what I tell folks, is that necessarily you have to decrease the number of calories you're eating.
Mm-hmm.
It can be important, and there are certain days that you may take in less than more, but you don't have to diminish your calories to some ridiculous level like 800 to 1,000. I mean, you can still eat, you know, depending again on what your goals are, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 calories, and you can still see, you know, weight change, weight loss, improvements in your numbers, all those good pieces.
Right.
And people, for those reasons, can tend to stay with it more consistently, because overall they're not going to be horribly hungry or horribly uncomfortable. And you can still, you know, drink plenty of fluids. I mean, that's another area I try to focus my patients or my clients on, is, you know, that's the other area where we get tons of just empty calories is fluid status.
Right.
You know, sweetened iced tea and sodas and even unsweetened sodas. You know, if it's a matter of me getting you from Coke to Diet Coke and then getting off Diet Coke, I can make that trade-off for sure.
Yes.
But unfortunately, some of the fake sugars still, when they go into your body, kind of act like glucose, and your body still recognizes them and releases insulin. And still, if you've got some insulin resistance, they're still going to give you some problems. So
yes,
even some of those can be problematic. But again, it's all a matter of kind of where a person or a patient is. If they've been doing a, you know, 2 liter of Coke, if I switch them to 2 liter of Diet Coke in the beginning, I can make that trade. And then hopefully we can wean them down off of that and start looking at some alternative options. Absolutely. That's kind of the art of this, not just the science, but it's the art as well.
Right.
Which I think is incredibly important, and to tailor it to this specific client. And that's the nice part of what I do and what you do and a lot of our other colleagues do, is try to really focusing on that N of one or that patient in front of you, not, okay, I've read this and 200,000 people did this and, you know, 150 got better. Well, what about the other 50? You fail on those. So that's where I think you've got to be able to morph a little bit and say, okay, yeah, ideally, do I want you drinking Diet Coke or do I want you doing some of this stuff? No, but there are opportunities to, you know, make an impact on that patient. If they're, again, accountable, then they're willing to make those changes, and you can definitely see some things moving forward. But ideally, going back to fluids, so, you know, filtered water, I think, is incredibly important. We can get into things like hydrogen water, which I think can be important as well. I do think a little salt in the water is important for the vast majority of people. Replacing minerals and electrolytes is incredibly important from that standpoint. We've been given conflicting data, I think, on salt intake and sodium intake. And
I agree. I agree.
Actually, has not been shown to be a significant problem or increase problem with hypertension with that. And then, you know, I do like unsweetened tea, and or I'm a coffee fan. And then they can do decaf if that's more advantageous to them. And there are a few other things that can be added. I mean, there are some seltzers that have very low or almost no calories and don't have fake sugars. But those would be the three go-tos, in my opinion, in trying to maintain good fluid status. So, and then I think the other piece that I really try to focus on is getting people enough protein. And, you know, we can get in fist fights and all the other pieces associated with that. But I think, and, you know, I treat everybody from about age of 15 all the way up to, I've had a couple hundred year olds. But as folks age, and probably starting, gosh, I'm starting early and earlier these days, but probably in 30s and up or 40s and up, we don't tend to get enough protein.
Doc, let me ask you something. In your experience, how many people do you see where you could say that they're eating too much protein?
I don't know that I found one.
Right. And that's kind of my thing too, especially like what you're saying with the age thing, you know, as we get older, I don't know that I've seen it either. And we keep close track. I mean, at least if they're being honest with us and we measure it, and it just doesn't seem to be enough for almost everybody. So that's very interesting. And real quick with the whole food thing too, as you're talking here, I'm thinking, you know, I early in my career, you know, because I've been like a low carb keto slash guy for a long time now. And early in my career, I try to, you know, everybody, you're on keto, everybody's on keto, you have this, you're keto. And I, you know, individuality is important. I can tell you specifically, I've seen people on a ketogenic diet who, for example, their triglycerides got worse. Yep. You know what I mean? So that's very important. Even me personally, I had gone to I was on the carnivore diet for a year, a couple of years ago. And the reason why I did it was I was on the paleo / keto diet for a long time, for years and years. And I had like some, you know, I guess I would consider to be mild bowel stuff going on that just wouldn't go away. I saw Dr. Sean Baker on Twitter talking about the carnivore diet. I did it, and that lingering stuff went away. And I did it for a year strict, and then I got back off, and I introduced, you know, some of the vegetables and fruit that I do okay with. But like you said, you know, I'm an active guy. I train a lot. I do Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and you know, I can afford, if I want to have 100 grams of carbs in a day because I train my butt off, I can get away with that, you know. So I'm right there with you on all that.
Right. And I try to make it easy. I'm not a calorie counter. I think that just creates more stress and anxiety in patients. Oh, I had, you know, this many calories, or I had not enough calories. I think it's a matter of, if you're eating proper foods and taking in proper foods, you're going to get, you know, satiety is going to hit and you're going to stop eating.
Right.
And that's where I think it's important for the proteins, because, you know, you can eat a lot of steak, but at some point you're just going to be like, okay, I'm full. I'm good.
Right.
and you know, it's nutrient dense, and that's one of the bigger pieces from that standpoint. I think one of the other kind of fallacies that we think of is every, you know, protein calorie that we take in, we don't use.
Right.
In fact, you know, the vast majority of it we actually lose by metabolism and some of the other things. So if you're looking, the most useful type of intake for protein would be eggs, because we use probably about 50 to 52% of that. If you start going down the chain, we get it down into the 30 and 40% for things like chicken and steak and venison or whatever other meat you want to put in there. So, you know, you could be taking in, you know, 250 grams of protein, but you may only be using or incorporating maybe less than half of that. So that's the important piece. And then, you know, even incorporating things like amino acids, whether it either be in powder form or capsules or tablets, can be very helpful.
Yes.
In getting people enough protein, because sometimes it is challenging to eat a bunch of meat, or people just don't do well with it from a GI or gut standpoint, or, you know, they don't have the means to buy tons of grass-fed meat or any
right.
sort of thing. So
right.
that's where I think the eggs can come in. That's where I think amino acids and some of the other pieces go in. So usually what I lean on is about a gram per pound of body weight per day, which I think is a reasonable number. And most people can hit that. When you tell them that and show them the number and show them what to eat, they look at you like you got three heads. But you know, I think it's important to kind of give them ideas on thoughts and what that means. And I'm not a Nazi on vegetables and fruits. You know, for the most part, vegetables, I think, have their role, and, you know, they do have, you know, the ability to kind of help improve overall health because of some of the micronutrients and phytonutrients.
Yes.
They, you know, have the ability to kind of allow us to adapt and help kind of stimulate some of our antioxidants naturally, which I think is incredibly important.
Yep.
Things like glutathione and some of the CERT enzymes and that sort of thing. But fruits, it kind of depends. I mean, I think some of them are incredibly important. The berries usually are quite good and
right.
you know, minimize elevations of blood sugars. Cherries typically are quite good from that standpoint. Kiwi is another one that's really good. Some of the others, unfortunately, can elevate blood sugars for long periods of time. Doesn't necessarily mean you can't eat those, but I
right.
wouldn't say, hey, eat two or three apples a day.
Right.
One may be very reasonable, and there's plenty of fiber and other nutrients in there that can be incredibly beneficial and helpful. But again, that's where you're going to your N of one, looking to see what happens with your blood sugars. And that's where, you know, even certain people that just aren't making any gains, sometimes a continuous glucose monitor can be helpful when you kind of just put it in under the skin.
Right.
It kind of monitors your blood sugars with whatever you eat. And
yes.
there may be some foods that for you may not be great, or for you may be fine.
Exactly.
And where, you know, some people do great with, say, a sweet potato, but other people, it would jack their blood sugars up for 4 hours and may not be the best choice for them. Some people may do great with oatmeal, and other people, that may be a very poor food choice for them. So
right.
That's a little extreme. And for the most part, those are not covered unless you do have a diagnosis of diabetes, either type 1 or type 2. But they can be ordered by docs, and they can be used to kind of gather information, get a better idea.
Yep.
If you're really trying to take a deep dive into your health and really trying to see, you know, what are potentially the best foods for you. And again, that's where epigenetics and some of the other pieces can come in. And I'll give you a quick story on that. I've got a colleague I've done a lot of work with, and we've been to multiple conferences, and we actually did some of our epigenetic training together. So one part of it is we test, you know, we typically test ourselves and then send it off and get our studies back. And he was similar to you and I. He tried, you know, keto and was really kind of a low carb kind of guy, and really wasn't making a whole lot of gains with that, and actually was gaining bad weight, gaining some fat, and didn't feel overall great when he was doing it.
Yep.
So he did the genetic evaluation, came back, and from what his epigenetics showed is he does much better if he eats anywhere from 200 to 250 carbs a day.
Mm-hmm.
So we started implementing that, kind of cutting back on some of the fats and or some of the proteins, still eating a reasonable amount according to what his epigenetics said, and lo and behold, started losing weight.
Nice.
Body composition got better, felt tons better. So again, it's not absolute with all of these type of things, and we're all, you know, wired and built differently. So I think that's where the positives come in.
I think,
and then just another quick piece on genetics before I let you jump in there, Nick.
No problem.
You know, everybody wants to fall back on that saying, well, it's my genetics that makes me fat, or it's my genetics that makes me tired, or my genetics that messes up my sleep. And there is some validity to that. Some of us are programmed for certain things, but the positive part is we have control over the way that those genes are expressed.
That's right.
So by doing, you name it, exercise being one of those things that is incredibly beneficial for the way that you express your genes. Taking B vitamins can be another thing that can be incredibly helpful for the way you express your genes and genetics. Limiting things like alcohol and other, you know, negatives can be of benefit. So we have control probably, and it's hard to say absolutely, but probably 80 to 90% of the way that our genes are expressed. So
I agree.
There are ways to make a significant impact in your health and work with your genetics and not just look at it and go and throw your hands up and go, well, I got this, I'm going to die at 50.
Right.
You can make some insignificant impacts with that if you are, you know, again, going back to our original point, accountable.
Right. I think that what you're saying, you know, you're echoing a lot in my mind as you're talking here. I'm just nodding my head thinking about, you know, everything that you're saying. I agree 100% with. And you had mentioned with, you know, the epigenetics and the testing, you know, I have a little bit of, I have a saying that we don't guess, we test. And this is kind of a good segue into the next thing I want to chat with you about. But I think that, like you mentioned, you know, at the foundation, you know, being human, being a human being, there are certain things as a foundation that we should be doing or living in accordance with because we just happen to be human beings. You know, I think of, and this might not be the best example because it's a different species, it's an animal, but I think of like a lion. One of my mentors always used to say, he said, lions do what lions do. You know, lions are carnivores. They hunt, they eat this amount of food, and then they may not eat for this time. They live like lions should live. And I think that foundationally humans are the same way, but I also feel that we are probably pretty far removed from, you know, from nature. You know, I think that maybe human beings as a species are probably the furthest removed from nature than any other species. So regarding that, when you had mentioned, you know, epigenetics and the testing, what are some things, this is something that I love talking about a lot, is influencing our genes. So let's go there if that's okay. What are some things that can negatively and even positively influence our genes?
Sure. So, I mean, it's similar to some of the things we've already discussed. I mean, you got to get your sleep dialed in. And if you can do that, that's going to positively enhance and impact your health overall in the way you express your genes. Stress reduction is another huge one. And again, I mean, it's not necessarily looking, and there typically are very limited options from a medication standpoint that will do that, unfortunately. It's easy to prescribe a benzodiazepine or at times an opioid or at times, you know, other anxiolytics that potentially can help that. And yeah, they're going to help short term. I'm talking, you know, day or two.
Right.
But downside is they cause significant side effect issues, really mess with your brain chemistry, and then cause significant addiction issues and problems that, you know, are very challenging to treat. And unfortunately, you know, people die from taking too many or
right.
A combination of things. So I think that's important. So getting your stress in order, I think, is a big piece. And you know, again, that's another one where you have about 99% control of the way you look at things, interpret things, work with things.
And that's, right.
Where, that's where I think some of the mind-body treatments are incredibly important. And you know, just quick aside on that, they've looked at folks with cancer and looked at everything potentially that could be either a positive or a negative for treatment, being what drugs are used, be it, you know, what they eat, be it family support or lack thereof, be it sleep, any of the other things from that standpoint. And the two things that out of all of those that were the most important were mindset. They had a yes. Positive look in life, and really we're going to face this and really hit it head on and really try to focus on, you know, moving it forward, not asking why me. And yeah, unfortunately that's going to happen to some right. degree, but it's okay to do that as long as you're not perseverating there, right. kind of moving it forward. And the other one was support, whether it be family, friends, church, however you get support. And if you've got great support around you and you feel part of a community, those were the two major pieces that improved your recovery and or your longevity. Now, did everybody do that? No, there's nothing that does everything from that piece, but I think that is a huge take-home message for anybody that has any type of problem. And that could be depression, that could be, again, joint pain, that could be, you know, you name it. So I think that is one of the bigger pieces that we can really focus on. Nutrition, some of the things we talked about from that standpoint, and, you know, diet has a significant role in the way that your genes are expressed.
What about environment, like environmental things? You know, that's
absolutely. Yep. And, you know, again, it's very challenging at times to get away from certain things in the environment. And
right.
We can't get away from all of them, but you need to do strategies to try to mitigate those type things. So, you know, air pollution, obviously, and if anything has been a bit of a positive from this virus has been the fact that, you know, a lot less cars, a lot less industries, that yep. sort of thing running, the air is actually much, much cleaner, and you can actually see certain parts of the country or the world now that you couldn't right. see because the pollution was so horrible. Yep. So I think that's important to do and try to come up with strategies to diminish what you breathe in and or breathe out. You know, plastics, unfortunately, have pretty significant negative side effects in all of our hormones, but especially for testosterone and or thyroid. Those are probably the two things that are incredibly negatively influenced by use of plastics and BPAs and a good number of things from that standpoint. So, you know, a good metal or a good glass or, you know, those sort of things can be a benefit. If you're looking at, you know, light and or the lack of natural light. So one of the more important things to do is just get out in some natural sunlight, probably at least 20, 30 minutes a day.
Right.
Just avoid that. Just positioning. I mean, that's another thing that people don't look at as environment is your posture. If you're seated all day or if you're right. doing nothing all day, I mean, what's going to happen? You're going to have a shortening of some of your musculature. Your back's going to be in a very poor and, you know, unhappy position. Your shoulders are going to be forward. Your chest and head are going to be forward, and but those
yeah, Dowager's hump going on,
right? And then that's going to affect your ability to breathe and take a deep breath and do some of the pieces from that standpoint. And it's overall going to negatively affect your health. You know, some of the 5G and some of the other technologies from that standpoint potentially yeah. have a negative effect on our health. And there are plenty of folks like Dr. McCullough, who's a big one on that. And
yeah,
if you really want to do a deep dive on that, I would definitely recommend looking at some of his work. But thought is that some people trying to get away from using wireless and go back to wired homes and that sort of thing, which potentially yeah. can help overall health. Environment's a big piece from that standpoint that, again, we do have a fair amount of control in. And then looking at things where you're going to try to detoxify yourself. And I know that's kind of a word that makes some people cringe and other people think, oh, you're a quack, you're talking about
right, right.
patient. Well, right. I understand. But simple things just to try to get rid of some of the crap that goes into your cells. So, you know, simple things like sweating. I mean,
yes.
I don't care how you do it. If you go outside and get in, you know, the sun and sweat out, that's wonderful because it's got some, you know, beautiful ways to get rid of just garbage, be it heavy right. metal, those sort of things. If you have the ability to get into a sauna or a red light sauna, that can kind of help you a great deal. A lot of that data has come out of the Scandinavian countries like Finland, where those folks do have saunas almost in all of their homes. And
right.
It's actually been shown to increase longevity, reduce risk of things like hypertension and stroke. Actually, it's been shown to be quite social, too, because you've got four or five people in a sauna at a time. And it's another way to kind of increase community feel and feeling that connectedness to some degree.
Yes.
cold therapies can be very helpful too. And another thing that I try to get folks to do is if they can't do a sauna, just get out and sweat and then do a cold shower. It's another way to kind of stimulate your vagus nerve and kind of stimulate your sympathetic with the heat and then the parasympathetic with, or let me go the other way around. Parasympathetic with the heat and the sympathetic with the cold and kind of shock your system a little bit, which can be very helpful all the way around. There's some simple strategies that can be employed to really try to help improve your overall environment. But I think one of the bigger keys is just getting outside and enjoying a little air and getting some sun and helping improve vitamin D levels and has been shown to improve overall mood and benefit from that standpoint too.
I think that, the topic of detoxification, because I know a lot of the things that you do, we do as well. And I want to talk about that next, getting into longevity and health span rather than lifespan. But just before we do that, for me, the idea of detoxification and you're right, people hear that and you can see their physiology change whenever you, when you mention that word. But a lot of the ways that I look at it is, like you said, sweating is a way, fasting is another way that you can do that too. But sometimes, depending on the individual and, we have a very, diverse practice, but depending on the individual, some of these therapies, and these are the things I want to talk to you about with you next, maybe temporarily that you have to do to kind of get ahead of the problem, right? I guess you can say in a certain situation, well, I hear that the body heals and I agree with that. The body does heal, but for certain people in certain instances, you kind of have to get some of this stuff going to kind of get ahead of the problem. People will say, well, we're equipped with detoxification organs. We're equipped with the liver and kidneys and guts and gallbladders and skin. But I feel like there's a certain point where you can be overburdened and you just, the body can't keep up with it. And sometimes you have to do these things. So let's go into, I guess, longevity and talk about health span, Doc. And, my whole thing about it is I watched a very interesting lecture with Peter Attia. I think I'm pronouncing it right, Peter Attia. And he was saying that these cultures that have people that live to be very, very old, centenarians, I guess you should say, these people, when they die, they're not dying of things that differently than we're dying, that, Westerners are dying from. That's not different. That's just happening to them a lot later in life. So, what is it that they're doing and maybe even things that we can do in our environment that can help us live a longer, healthier life, not just live longer in a nursing home hooked up to machines, but actually longer. So, maybe we can kind of talk about some supplements, hormones, peptides, the IV stuff that we were chatting about.
Sure. And again, I think the biggest piece with, if you're looking at those and, the blue zones and the book on that is quite good to read. A lot of it was the low-hanging fruit and some of the things we talked about before as far as connectedness, as far as low-level activity each day, quality food, quality fluids. Typically, they did tend to have an alcoholic beverage or two each night. And,
right.
And the passion for life, I think, was another one. And then really the connectedness of the family. It wasn't necessarily that the older folks were kind of shunned from the family. They were actually, raised up and really made kind of a deity to some degree and learning the wisdom and some of the other actions and passing that down to all the generations. But I think to me, nothing's off the table. So as I start looking at people and clients and as we get some of the baseline things looked at and really dialed in, then I think you've got to go up the chain a little bit and look at things like hormone levels. As we age, I'm probably starting, depending on what hormone you're talking about, but again, probably ballpark 30 to 40 years of age, we start losing levels of hormones, which can cause significant problems all the way around, whether it's recovery from exercise, whether it's brain function, whether it's cardiovascular function, whether it's gut-related issues, whether it's skin changes and problems, whether it's, again, cancers and some other things and pieces from that standpoint. So, again, going back to, kind of how I found and started incorporating hormones into my management treatment, There's a group called the American Academy of Orthopedic Medicine. That's kind of where I learned how to do prolotherapy and PRP and stem cells. And probably 2010, 2011, 2012, somewhere in that ballpark, was a gentleman there by the name of Dr. Neil Rousier, who was an emergency medicine physician by trade, but had started doing hormones and had come up with a process and a course to kind of teach other docs how to do that. Right. And he gave a lecture or two at one of the meetings, and you know, I was just blown away because he uses the literature, which is incredible. It's not just, this is what I do it this way. I mean, he goes and has tons of research and evidence-based treatments for why he does what he does. And it's basically a total 180 from what we learned in medical school and some of the other things that we were doing, and really kind of opened my eyes because, you know, as you're coming in as a young doc, you think you can fix everything. And after a while, you're like, you know, the things I'm doing aren't helping the vast majority of folks I'm seeing. And that's when you start hopefully looking for some alternative options and trying to really help people. And that's how I got into the regenerative world. And then it kind of dovetailed into the hormones and then, you know, peptides and some of the other things that I'm doing. But to take that with what I was doing, so he started talking to people after I took some of Dr. Rousier's courses and just listening to their stories. Almost everybody was tired and almost everybody was not recovering from exercise as they liked to, and their brain wasn't working as well as they would like, and they were gaining weight even though they were trying to do a lot of the good things. You know, they weren't sleeping particularly well, and some of the other things, even though overall it sounded like they were implementing what you're recommending, and they weren't healing from some of the regenerative things I was doing. So as I started checking some of the levels on some of the folks, a lot of them had significant deficiencies, be it in testosterone, be it in thyroid function, be it in even simple things like vitamin D, and vitamin B levels. And, you know, once you start replacing them and looking at the data, actually has been shown to help improve overall lifespan, overall health span, overall recovery, and significant reduction in morbidity and mortality. So, you know, something that we, with where I am here at Rejuve Medical and some of the other places around the country, have really used this as a focus to try to get people up to the point where they now have the building blocks to heal and recover. And, you know, it's a big part of what I do as far as practice. And again, typically, yes, along with some of the foundations of lower hanging fruit, I try to get people's hormone levels up to, you know, close to optimal, if not optimal, before we even consider doing a regenerative procedure, because their outcomes tend to be just so much better. And people are unbelievably happier when they are optimized. I'll give you a quick story. I had a gentleman who was 50 years old, came in, it was probably 6 months ago, somewhere in that ballpark, and really was morbidly depressed. I mean, to the point where when he was sitting there, he would not make eye contact with me at all. His wife had come with him and, you know, was very concerned about his health and was worried that, you know, he may potentially consider harming himself. So we got in a discussion and he was pretty forthright with what was going on, but he still was just like mostly talking to my feet or talking to the floor and occasionally making that contact with me. It was just, you know, it made you feel terrible for the guy just because you could tell he was hurting and was just not in a good spot at all. And, you know, we talked about a good number of things, including counseling. At that stage, he was not willing to move forward with treatment. So I got him going on naltrexone, which is actually a drug that in higher doses is good for people with opioid and alcohol abuse issues, but in lower doses actually has been shown to be helpful for a good number of things. One of those being mental health issues, sometimes can be very helpful for people with autoimmune issues, sometimes can be good for folks with chronic pain, sometimes can be helpful for anti-aging treatments and reasons, but got him on that, got him going pretty quickly, got a battery of blood work, and, you know, his testosterone was incredibly low, his thyroid was way off, his vitamin D levels were way off, and those were probably the major abnormalities that I found, and got him started on treatment, got him back in 6 weeks, and he was like a totally different person, looking up at me, heads up, you know, these very engaging, very animated. He's totally happy with the way things were going. He and his wife were having sex again, which was a total change from where they were before. He was looking for new and different things to add to his regimen. And, you know, we started talking about some peptide therapy, some other things. But, and I'm not saying every patient is that way, and I'm not saying that that's totally the norm, but you see significant differences in the way that people interact with you and work with you and get dialed in. I mean, going back to what we talked about with accountability, it helps with accountability because now they're able to listen. Now they're able to interact and understand, and they're not just focused, like you said in the beginning, about their pain or on their other issues going on. So it can be an incredibly helpful and powerful piece. And then the other thing, looking at from a musculoskeletal standpoint, along with the fact that it helps with building blocks, we've got tons of receptors in our bones, soft tissues, that sort of things, for both testosterone and progesterone. And especially women, if I can get them on progesterone and even testosterone, a lot of their joint symptoms significantly improve. Not saying they go away, I'm not saying they totally resolve, but it's another way that I can help to improve their pain besides having to inject them or do some other pieces from that standpoint. So again, it's kind of a total approach, or if you want to call it a holistic approach, but basically looking at them as a total human or a total person, as opposed to, hey, you got a knee problem, or hey, you got a hip problem. So again, it's really changed the way that I've been able to practice and manage people. And people really, I think, have taken to it. Now, there's a few, unfortunately, that have been negatively influenced by media or by other docs or other things, saying that all of those are going to cause cancer. And I talk to them calmly and try to show them the literature,
right,
pieces associated with that. That's not a true statement. We talk about things like, lower testosterone levels, typically higher risk of dementia and Alzheimer's. That usually gets people's attention. Usually with my men, lower levels of testosterone, usually higher levels of prostate cancer. And that's reversed, and much lower risk. We talk about thyroid in relation to cardiovascular disease, and when you're optimized there, you tend to have better cardiac output and better cardiac function. We talk about the positives with estrogen and estradiol for women moving forward, and the fact that once they hit menopause, then their cardiovascular heart attack risk goes higher than a male's, and their risk of dementia and Alzheimer's actually increases and is higher than a male.
Right.
So it's another piece that we can add to really try to get people dialed in and kind of get them moving forward and allow them to maintain their independence, allow them to do the things they want or need to do comfortably, and really try to get them optimized and transformed to the point where, I think it is possible moving forward that we're going to live to 120, 125 pretty comfortably, without significant side effect issues. And some thought that, looking at our children at this stage, if they're below 15, that they're maybe the first 200-year-old human. So, and I think this has to be part of it. And another one, if you're on the fence with it, another great book is The End of Alzheimer's by Dr. Dale Bredesen.
I read that. It's amazing.
Yeah, and he is a neurologist by trade, and I would say the vast majority of neurologists, I would say, are not on the hormone bandwagon. That's just kind of the way that field is. But he goes into wonderful detail as to the reasons that most treatments for Alzheimer's and or dementia have failed, because everybody wants it to be a magic bullet. They want it to be a one or two type treatment interventions, and it's just not going to work out that way. So he goes into pretty significant detail on the fact that he suggests, folks take upwards of 30 to 36 supplements. He's a big proponent of bioidentical hormone replacement for the things we talked about. Big proponent of diet change. He's more of a plant guy than probably I am, but that's okay. He's got his reasons, and he supports it with the literature, which I think is great. Great for exercise. I mean, he kind of really walks it out there as the reasons why this is incredibly important, and or there's the reasons why there's not just going to be a simple treatment for these type issues, and he's shown pretty significant benefits. So if you have some interest in looking at a different perspective on hormones and other treatments, especially as it relates to Alzheimer's, that's a wonderful resource. And you know, Dr. Ruzier's courses, there's some other ones, A4M, American Academy of Anti-Aging and Medicine has some wonderful courses as well. There are some other really good sources from that standpoint, but it's not hard to implement. It does take you some time to learn, and you have to follow the patients and kind of follow them out. And the other piece is, it's not just a numbers game. You're not just looking purely at the numbers. Again, this is where the art comes in, is you're looking more at a clinical response. And, you know, some people may get a great clinical response and they haven't hit optimal levels, which is fine. And there are other people that you have to kind of drive even above optimal levels because they haven't quite gotten a response yet. And as long as you are following it, documenting it, noting those side effects, you know, you're doing your due diligence, the likelihood of having a major issue is low. So I think that's the important piece too. Then the other thing that you've got to reiterate with your patients, if you're going to go down this road, is typically this is going to be a lifetime intervention. This isn't something you're going to be able to do for a few months or a few years. Can they come off of it? They can. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but then they're going to lose the protections and the positive effects of doing the hormones too. So, and you know, as things move forward, are we going to be able to change? And maybe there are going to be different ways that we can replace. Absolutely. I think technology is going to make this totally different at some point in the future. Yeah. But it's just something that you have to reiterate and follow with your patients. You know, tell them the pros, tell them the cons, give them, you know, potential side effect issues, and follow them on a regular basis. In the beginning, usually we'll see them every 6 to 8 weeks, doing blood work each time, not necessarily a whole battery, but just kind of the things that we're adjusting. And then anything that could be affected. So, for example, if you're doing testosterone, you kind of want to follow along their blood counts, because their hemoglobin hematocrit can go up. Usually not a major issue, but you want to make sure it doesn't go too high. And also, you know, liver function can sometimes be affected by testosterone, so you want to follow those pieces along. But usually once you've got them on more of an optimal dose, they're feeling good, they're comfortable, and then following probably 6 months with repeat blood work would be the way to go. And then, you know, the dovetail onto that is the newer kid on the block, even though they've been around for a while, are the peptides. Yes. And peptides are basically small chains of amino acids or small proteins that have effects in the body that can do anything from improving hair growth to improving skin health to improving sexual function to improving aesthetics, strength, joint pain, you name it. Now, this is where with COVID and some of the other things that have happened, I think the government kind of has overstepped their bounds a little bit. One of the main producers of peptides, it's called TaylorMade Pharmacy. It's in Kentucky. FDA went in there probably 3 weeks ago, somewhere in that ballpark, and basically shut them down. Well, they're able to do some work, but they were not able to make all the peptides that they were able to do before. And, you know, there were multiple potential reasons for that. They had no issues with what they were making as far as what they made was what they made. So there wasn't any garbage or fillers in it. They had no issues with sterility, anything like that whatsoever. They did have, you know, potential relation, as I think one of their former owners was part of the horse issue with giving them, you know, too many steroids and some of the other things.
Yes.
So I got investigated for that. And then unfortunately part of it, and you know, this is a true statement, is I think the government overstepped and or big money and big pharma felt threatened and has kind of limited, unfortunately, some of the things that we may be able to get in the future. So some of them are still going to be available. And the good part is we're going to start doing some studies and review boards that we can start doing some treatments with some of the things that had to be stopped. But I think we've got to be a little bit worried with some of the civil liberties and some of the things that have gone on. And I think we've got to be pretty vigilant with that and kind of monitoring those issues.
I agree.
There was another clinic in Detroit physician had, and it was interesting, and maybe there's more to the story I haven't heard yet, but at least from what was purported, he was giving reasonable and higher dose vitamin C IVs to first responders and docs and anybody that was involved in the COVID thing. And he was even doing them free if need be. And I'm not sure what happened, but the feds went in and kind of shut him down. Now, there may be more of the story, and I'm not saying that there's not, but
right.
At least on the surface, it was a question why they would be doing that if he was treating some of the people that needed to remain healthy. So, it bothers me moving forward. And some of the things that have gone on even before COVID have been a bit of a problem. But I think that's where we've got to be very into watching, and checking the government. And where the situation unfortunately has made us more dependent on government services and that sort of thing. So,
when you're saying this, I kind of feel the same way that you do about it. And I know, cause we've been doing the same things now, what you're talking about, some of these therapies and all that and the IVs for some time now. And, you hear about these things happening before you get into practice or before you start implementing these things. And, you hear that, the reasons why it's happening and all this and that. And I think that, I guess, most importantly, for us, for example, there's a whole, before we do any of this stuff, we see these people, there's an examination, there's labs to make sure that there's nothing that, that's not harmful and all this and that. So as long as we're, doing things safely and ethically, that's all that we can do. But something that I want to mention that you're talking about, which I feel, that when people listen to this, it might gently go over their head, but I feel is very important, is that what you mentioned. By the way, I love how you say you refer to the essential stuff as low hanging fruit. I love that. And if you're okay with them, I'm going to start using it. But, what's interesting is sometimes we'll have people come in and they want to ignore their lifestyle things that need to be improved and jump right to this stuff,
Right.
And we always have the conversation like it just doesn't work that way. And I can tell you everything from cancer to maybe, black mold exposure, severe mold, where people are saying, I understand, you have a reputation for lifestyle, but I don't want to change any of that stuff. I just want you to do this for me. And we turn people away for that. I care about people, but I care about my license too. You know what I mean? So, we got to do the right thing with that. But one thing here too, Doc, by the way, I need to get you back on here because there's things on here that I know that we haven't covered that I want to cover, but what I do want to cover before we go is discuss the burnout thing. Just to kind of give you, before I let you take the mic here, just on a personal level, I've only been in practice for 2020, for about 13 years, 12 years. And early on, I think this is just me personally, I felt a little bit of burnout, and I think for me personally, it was taking things home with me where, you realize that you have potential to help a lot of people. You have a good team around you and you know that you have something very special for people and you can truly help a lot of people. And for me, it seemed like about half were kind of doing their part. And I would always ask myself, man, why in the world are these people not, maybe it was ego. I'm not going to, deny that, a little bit of ego there. But it's, for me, it was, man, these people, it seems like they just don't want help. And finally, when I was having this conversation with my wife and she said, listen, if you're going to do this, if we're going to do this, then, you just have to kind of put that away, realize that you can't help everybody either because they're not going to follow through or for whatever reason, if you're okay with that, you help who you help and you just kind of go through. So let's, I'm gonna let you talk about the burnout part of this stuff.
Sure. So, probably hit me bad probably around 2015. So I had been in smaller orthopedic groups starting when I started my career in 2000 up to about 2011. And there's multiple things I could talk about, but one of them is I'm a non-surgeon. I was in surgical groups primarily the whole time. So to some degree, you're seen as a little bit of a second class citizen. So
yeah.
And, you know, that's neither here nor there, but it does impact the way that you are included or interpreted or valued to some degree. So about that time, 2011, we were not in dire straits, but the area where I was becoming very competitive. So it was three things were going to happen. We were going to either implode and just everybody's going to go their own way. We were going to join a larger entity, or a larger orthopedic group, and or join the hospital. So we joined a larger orthopedic group, which out of the three was the best choice. And, overall, well run, but it was huge. And basically at that stage, you were a number. You were just kind of a cog in the wheel, and they didn't really give you a lot of autonomy to kind of choose what you were able to treat and not treat. About that time, I was getting more into regenerative medicine, so I wanted to incorporate it. And then they let me do some of the prolotherapy, which is dextrose treatment. PRP, they weren't all that keen on. They let me do it, but it was really kind of a money-losing proposition because we really weren't looking at costs and negotiating and really trying to even advertise or push. And that's about the time I started, you know, picking up on hormones and some of the other pieces from that standpoint. Actually, I worked with one of my joint surgeons who was having challenges getting people to a certain weight so they could get their knees and hips done. I worked with about three or four of them and got them down to the weight. And I was happy and he was happy and the patient was happy. So I put together a pretty good presentation similar to a lot of things we've talked about, kind of employing whether it be exercise, diet, hormones, any other pieces to really try to get people tuned up. And with the understanding, I told them that probably this will hit about 5 to 10% of our patient population, but with where we were, that was going to be a huge number. And I thought it would be a good moneymaker and satisfying for me and some of the other pieces because I was very passionate about it. And basically they looked at me and said, no, we want you to stop doing that. We're not really going to pursue that. Became very disenfranchised. And at that stage too, I wasn't sleeping particularly well and some of the other things we talked about, my hormones were off. So that was another problem. My stress levels were high. I just was not healthy at all either. So, I was seeing probably 120, 150 patients a week. And it was, again, you just felt like you were on that rat wheel. And with the fact that similar to what I told you before, I was probably helping, two or three or four out of, 30 I would see a day, which was good. But then you had the other people that really were not there to be treated. They were there because somebody else had sent them. They were, had been injured on the job and weren't really into trying to improve, or there were a myriad of other reasons. So, it just got to the point where I just felt overwhelmed to the point where, I became very down. I became very angry. I became very just disengaged from life and from my family and even stopped even exercising as much as I had because that was kind of my, escape to some degree. I changed jobs and have done that a few times, trying to find my tribe and trying to find where I need to go. But it's been a bit of a challenge really to try to manage that and overcome it. And I've done a ton of work from a mind body standpoint, similar to some of the things we talked about with meditation and some counseling and really cleaning my diet up has been a big piece. I'll be honest with you. Out of any of the things I've done, that's probably been the best as it and is the cheapest. Sleep has improved. I did get a sleep study, and that's something we didn't talk about, but another piece, especially for guys, but even girls too. Everybody's like, oh, I don't want a CPAP. Well, if you're sleeping terrible and you're not breathing, that's probably a CPAP. So I do have CPAP. So I do use that on a nightly basis and some other things to really try to manage my sleep and really worked on some of the detoxification pieces, really try to do some heat therapy each day, cold therapy each day, and some other things. But, it's unfortunately, it's to some degree a nature of the beast and the nature of the business to some degree. There's always challenges with new electronic medical records, and trying to document all that stuff takes a lot of time and a lot of time away from your family. There's always, you know, concerns about being sued, similar to what you talked about before. You're always getting paid almost seemingly less and having to do more to get that money if you're not doing a cash-based service or direct primary care type service. Right now I'm kind of in a situation where I'm doing a hybrid. So we do have some cash base and we do some insurance as well. And then some of it's the culture of the organizations and those sort of pieces. Some of it's, you know, it's your problem, suck it up and deal, and you're not going to get with the program, then the heck with you. Others are a little bit more in tune to that and will, you know, try to get you some help and really try to work with you to try to manage some of these issues, or again, try to find some other areas where you are passionate about and maybe mm-hmm. could incorporate that into what you're doing. And, you know, unfortunately, it's also the time that, you know, 40 to 60 is when our hormones start going haywire. Right. There's potential issues with marriage and relationships. And in those times, you know, your wife potentially, or your husband, or your significant other may be going through similar changes. Maybe, you know, you're going in different directions at that stage. So that becomes hard. You know, if you have children, they could be of any age. They could be young. They could be out of the house. They could be a good number of things from that standpoint. You're dealing potentially with older parents that may be having some health issues. So that's kind of drawing you away from what you're doing. It kind of just drains you physically, mentally, emotionally, all pieces. And I think it makes you just less than a person. And, you know, I remember times that I'd just come home and, you know, hop in the bathtub and sit in there for 2 hours just trying to get away, and then get out and just lay in the bed for a period of time. And that would be my evening. And sometimes it worked and I felt better. Other times it didn't. You know, other times I'd try to go out and just out exercise it, or feel back or a punch, or, and again, sometimes it helped, sometimes it didn't, but it's again, an all over body thing. It's not just your head. It's not just your physical part. It's your heart. It's your everything you've worked for. At times just seems like you're not reaping, and you're right. Some of the folks you're dealing with make that even a little bit more challenging. So, you know, in trying to move forward, I think some of the bigger keys, in my opinion, are trying to find some like-minded people that you really want to work with. Does that mean you have to get along 100%? No, similar to what I talked about with patients, sometimes a little combustibility can actually make things move forward, but you really all have to be kind of rowing in the same direction with yours.
Yes. So
I think that's incredibly important. And I think the other thing that we really have to look at in healthcare is, and this sounds mean, this sounds difficult, but I think it's true, is I think you have to attract the people that you want to treat.
100%, man. 100%.
And, you know, it works both ways. I mean, if a patient comes in and you guys don't get along, they're not going to get anything out of it either. And it's a waste of their time.
Let me interject real quick. I'm sorry. And I'm gonna let you go ahead. That's just, I am a big proponent of patients interviewing the physician. I am just as much of a proponent as the physician interviewing the patients. 100%. Go ahead. Sorry, doc.
No, I think that's perfect. And I think that's one of the parts that we, you know, as we're coming up, we're all altruistic and we feel like we can help everybody and we want to try to help everybody. And again, when you're young and spry and all those sort of things coming out, and you're a little bit naive, which isn't always a bad thing, then you kind of learn, well, wait a minute, this isn't doing good things for me other than raising my cortisol levels and raising my sympathetic tone and making my life miserable. And then, you know, you get the negative reviews and some of the other things that sometimes people can hold over your head. And again, I mean, it's, everybody's like, well, I don't do this for money. Well, I don't do it for 5-star reviews either.
Right.
I do it because I'm passionate about it. And I do it because I want to help people transform and really kind of be the best of them they can be. And, you know, are there folks that I just don't click with? Yes. Are there folks that don't click with me? Absolutely. And it's, you know, it's not one way. And, you know, I think that's a big piece. I think we've got to really get into healthcare is really trying to manage the folks that you can. Now, in certain instances, that's not possible. Emergency medicine, nah, you're probably not going to be able to do that. Right. If general surgery, if it's an emergency, no, you're not going to be able to do that. Neurosurgery, if for emergency, no. I mean, there are certain pieces that you just, you can't do that on. But for some elective or the vast majority of elective type things, I think that's incredibly important because you're right. You got to go home and you got to be there for the people that are at home. Or I think the bigger piece that I try to reiterate everybody is be there for yourself.
Yes.
And that's the thing where I think I just totally lost myself. And you know, I beat the living shit out of myself many years and still do at times. And I'm my own worst enemy for the most part. I will raise my hand on that 100%. And, you know, going back to what we talked about with stress and some of the other things, yeah, I have sabotaged myself at points. But the other thing it has shown me is, okay, you can sit there and be in misery and you know, loathe yourself and you know, be angry all the time. Or you can go, okay, that day didn't go so well. Let's learn from that. Let's take from that what's, you know, I'm going to use as a positive moving forward. And try to, you know, if you want to use the word fix or manage is probably a better word in my opinion, and just become a better person that day. And am I always successful? No. But do I try to, you know, make progress each day? Yes, I think that's the important piece. And, you know, a lot of what's happened with this disease and in certain pockets, I mean, you know, the good things that have come out of it with more interaction with family and that sort of thing, I mean, some
absolutely.
Some of the healthcare workers, unfortunately, are taking the brunt of this, and
right.
There's some going to be a lot of negativity coming out of it, and them not managing themselves, similar to a lot of things we've talked about here. And you know, I definitely want to be there to try to help with that, and be a mentor, and treat, and some other pieces. I mean, you know, the other thing that I've done, one of my colleagues, who is an anesthesiologist by trade, is I did some low-dose ketamine treatments, or IV ketamine, I should say, just because I felt like I was kind of stuck or just was not progressing. And very eye-opening and really made me look at some different perspectives and ways that I could try to manage some of my mental health challenges. So, you know, and I think, does it have to be that? I don't even want to call that extreme, but does it have to be like that? No, it doesn't. I mean, there are a lot of other things that can be done, but understand that there are potential options available that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path that can be of benefit in helping to improve folks. I mean, even some simple thing, or it's relatively simple. I mean, hyperbaric oxygen therapy can be incredibly helpful for a good number of things, but mood being one of them. Some of the things you do with ozone can be another piece that can be very helpful with that. IV therapies can be outstanding for that. A lot of times doing both of those, and you can meditate at the same time, you can really get yourself some pretty significant benefits from that stage too. So, you know, it's a big problem, and probably outside of the military, you know, there's at least one to two docs that commit suicide each day. And yeah, it's pretty significant. And I got a text from one of my buddies today who was in the military, and latest studies are pretty sad on that. He noted about 22 vets commit suicide daily, which is just another area that we need to address pretty significantly.
Absolutely.
But it's you know, definitely an area that I want to focus some attention on and kind of come up with you know, online course and or an in-person course and some other ways to really try to help my brothers and sisters from that standpoint, because I've been there and it ain't fun.
Yeah.
And you know, I think looking at it from multiple ways, not just, hey, manage your stress, but there's some other reasons physiologic that may be going on that we can help to fix. Or maybe you haven't thought of this, but I've got people that if you want to switch careers or you want to look at cash pay services or you want to look at, you know, maybe something outside of your main job, we've got that available. Or you know, there may be some alternative therapies that you weren't aware of. That, hey, I've got a colleague, if you're willing to travel here, we can do some of these type of things. So it's a horrible feeling. And again, it's unfortunate that it has to happen. But there are ways to really impact it from a positive standpoint. Again, it starts with the things we talked about with the foundations and kind of going up the chain and looking at potential options to really try to manage some of these issues. And yeah, there's plenty of toys that we can look at using, which may be very helpful and very advantageous, but it still comes back to the fundamentals, in my opinion. So I still
think I agree. That's
where we need to start, and I absolutely agree with you. And similar to you, I have turned some patients away from treatments that they really wanted because there was no way they were going to get a great response or a great outcome.
Right.
And you know, that part of that's your reputation, but part of that's just the fact that you know. And you don't want them to spend a bunch of money on something you know is not going to work, and then
exactly
have that back on you. I'd rather have them be mad up front than after they've spent, you know, whatever it's going to cost, be a $5,000 to $10,000.
Right.
On something that you're like, nope, you're just not going to get it done. And that's where I've become a little bit better as far as saying, look, if you're not willing to put these parts in and do the work here, I don't see you being able to do this. And you
know, exactly.
Has that caused hard feelings at times? Sure. But
right.
You've got to be willing to say no at times. And I think that's incredibly important.
Yeah.
And again, going back to the, you know, the review type thing, you know, the folks that tend to get higher reviews tend to have poorer outcomes. And if you look at it, that's a true thing.
Yes, 100%.
And I'm not saying that, you know, the people that get good reviews don't do good work, because they absolutely do. I'm not trying to criticize those folks either. But sometimes they don't do things that are in the best, are going to be the best for the patient. They're doing it because they don't want to cause a, you know, rift or a problem, and really don't want to manage that type issue. So I think you've
right.
got to be willing to stick to your guns and say, look, this isn't going to work for you. I may have somebody else that I could send you to, or I'm happy
right.
to share records with whomever you want to go to. But I think you've got to be willing to say no. And I think you're right. I think you've got to really screen your clients and patients coming in and make sure that they are similar to your mindset. They don't have to be exactly
right.
the same, but and again, it helps you grow too. If you got a little bit of a clash, if they push back on you too. I mean, if they're doing that, they're doing their reading, they're doing their research, they're doing the things that you know, we have recommended. I'm totally into it. That
yes.
tells me that this patient is really into it and they really are applying themselves. So I'm okay with a little bit of back and forth. I think that's important. It doesn't have
I agree.
To be again negative. It's just helps you transform. I mean, it's like your family. I mean, you fight with your family quite a bit, but if anybody
right.
starts charging at your family, you all are going to be there ready to pounce. So it's kind of the same thing. I mean, it's, you know, and we all have bad days both ways. I mean, there's some patients come in, I'm like, you're having a bad day.
Right.
And sometimes I have bad days. And,
yes.
you know, some patients are keen to that. They're like, you okay?
Yeah,
and those are the people that I really want to thank, because they're in tune to what's going on with life. So they pick me up as much as I pick them up too. So it works both ways.
And I think too that's important, because the way that I know that you look at it is that the relationship that you have with your patients, it's a partnership, right? Not a dictatorship. And I think that when there's conversations going on, you know, you're not rolling with an iron fist, and they're bouncing things off of you. You're bouncing things off of them, and it's open, and they understand that this guy here, you know, he's here for me, and he's not just here for his own interest. And I think that's very important. But, you know, doc, like I said, I think for me, you know, just, you know, we talked behind the scenes a few times, and I think that one of the things that, and I appreciate you being here with me, that I learned that is that there are doctors out there like you that not only listen, you can have doctors that are good at what they do. And I consider you to be one of those doctors, but at the same time too, you have a heart for it, and you can have these conversations with patients, and it's not, and people knowing that, feeling comfortable with that, the outcomes, in my opinion, are only going to be better. But like I said, doc, I need to get you back, because there's things I know that we had here that we didn't talk about. But before we go, do me a favor, let everybody know, where people can find you, and they can get on your website or wherever they can find you, please.
Sure. So you can find me at Michael Meehan, MD. Meehan is MEIGHENMD .com, or livelimitless.com, or excuse me, livelimitlessmd.com. And then the current clinic I'm at is at Rejuve Medical. So that's www.rejuvemedical.com. And then I'm on all social media except for, what am I not on? I'm on Facebook, I'm on Twitter, I'm on LinkedIn. So those are the primary ones I use.
What's your book again, Doc?
The book is called A New You, Using the Body's Regenerative Restorative Healing Powers to Optimize Orthopedic, Hormonal, and Sexual Health Function. Beautiful. And then I'm also working on a book collaboration called The Codes of Longevity that will probably be out sometime in September, October. So I'm writing a chapter along with 20 of my colleagues, and then we're going to have some big hitters coming in like Aubrey de Grey and potentially Ben Greenfield and a few other people writing a chapter.
Awesome. And then we're good stuff, Doc.
Virtual summit at some point in October, I believe. So I can definitely let you know when that may be. So
yeah, appreciate it. And Doc, listen, I have to say, man, I enjoyed this time. I'm going to get you back on here. I appreciate everything that you do. Hang on for a second. Guys, appreciate it. Episode 2 in the books with Dr. Meehan. We'll talk to you later.